This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're here with our co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
And we're just so excited to have you, Darrell. You know, we love having you join us on these episodes.
Love being here, Tony.
Excellent. So today we're going to be speaking with Russell Granite. Now, you are the president of New 42, but you're also just an extraordinary leader in the arts and education space, and you've won numerous honors. You recently were named by Crain's New York as 2020 Notable LGBTQ Executive. You've also served as advisor on the Mayor's Cabinet for Children, and you're a trustee of the Times Square Alliance, Bank Street College, and Sherman and Fairchild Foundation. So we're so excited to have you, but what makes me most fascinated is the fact that you loved Julia. You talk about how you, but there's something more too. You also, in my research, I learned that Oliver was your first play. Mine too, Russell. So you loved Julia. You also loved Oliver. And you weren't the greatest standardized test taker. So I said to myself, I said, this man is me.
Separated at birth.
We are friends. So talk to us a little bit about why you love Julia.
You know, I think it's not uncommon to connect with something where you see yourself. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about Julia is, you know, I don't look like Julia or her son.
Exactly.
Except for the fact that Julia, Diane Carroll, beautiful. Mm-hmm. My mother, beautiful. Julia was divorced raising a 7-year-old boy, and my mom was divorced raising a 7-year-old boy. And I think that really speaks to, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is representation.
Absolutely.
And see, you know, I didn't know what I was seeing at that time. All I knew is that
pure
story was comfortable to me.
It
made no difference that they were a different race. They were, you know, what connected with me was the idea that this was a single woman. Cause when I was growing up, I was the only child in my grade school that was being raised by a single mother.
Oh, wow.
And so it was, very impactful at that point.
Excellent. Excellent. And Oliver.
So Oliver, I saw myself on stage, right? It's like, you know, I was 7, he was 7. You know, again, those were all my very early experiences seeing theater that totally transformed my life.
Excellent.
So we'd like to talk a little bit about the power of art. And, you know, of course, you know, you lead a New 42 Youth Corps that's empower students and et cetera in the arts. And if I look at the statistic, it's quite impressive, the work that you do. It's, if you don't mind, it's 675,000 students who have experienced live theater, 1,600 New York City youths who've acquired and achieved professional and personal success, and over 1 million viewers nationwide, and almost 1,400 new works. That's quite an impressive record. So what would you say about the power of art, power of art to move people, the power of art to move communities and society?
I think the focus that I've always had is I'm not a career transplant. I've only ever done this, right? I didn't do something else and then move into this world. I was right out of NYU educational theater program. I was a teaching artist. And from there, my career, grew. And I have always said, cause parents are my biggest stumbling block, because parents somehow feel that if their child goes into the arts, they're going to be an unemployed artist.
So true. Starving artist.
Starving artist.
You're going to be on my bank account.
That's right. For a long time. And they, and I understand that. And there are stats that support this, which is if you're new to the country, you didn't come here to have your child be unemployed. You came here for your child to become an engineer or an attorney or a doctor. And so for me, the power of the arts is that what it does is it gives these young people the imagination and the skills to imagine a different life. And so I don't really think my work is about creating young artists. I want people to think like artists. I don't necessarily need them to become artists. And I think if more people thought the way an artist, you know, thinks on a daily basis, we'd be in a better place.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I know that Stanford University actually has a design program, not to create designers, but to imbue business people with the sensibilities of design
thinking.
Design thinking. Yeah. So
You know, so in a moment of radical transparency, Russell, I've had the honor to be your student at NYU, and also to work with you at Lincoln Center as well. So to say that you're one of my mentors would be a gross understatement. But with that, I want the listeners of Art Moves to know exactly why I go to you for this type of guidance. Let's think about brain development and human development. How early should the arts be introduced to young people?
It starts when they're in utero, you know, listening to music, hearing stories. And we know from our research at New 42 that the sweet spot is somewhere between 3 and 10. And if you, as a young person, and it's interesting, it's field trips are important. And I always believe those experiences are valuable, but there is something about going to the theater with a trusted adult that our research says is key to sustaining and creating a habit. So what we know is that if you're the ages between 3, 4, 9, 10, and you go to the theater a minimum of 3 times with a trusted adult, a habit begins to form. Doesn't mean that a habit can't form in middle school and high school. It's just much harder. And what's interesting, on the 4th visit, and we see this in our own research, young people begin to create an opinion. And so the first 3 times, they're sitting on the edge of their chair and they're looking out the stage and they're like, oh, that's live, you know, and how cool. And then the 4th time, they're like, it was a little slow in the first act. Like, you know, they all. It is this amazing thing that happens, that sort of 4th time. But there are a lot of families, and we have to acknowledge the fact that the term art is an elitist term. And for some people, that means it's for other people and not for them.
And I wanted to kind of, if you don't mind, Darrell, I just wanted to go right into that. How do we make art something where everyone feels welcome, everyone feels seen, everyone's art is appreciated? And by everyone, I'm talking about all cultures, that we're not so beholden to a European standard.
Well, there's a little bit of swimming up the stream. That I'm interested to hear what your opinion is about. There is a view in puritanical culture that art is just, you know, not important. You know, it's mathematics, science, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. But
so that's the background behind what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting. Art, when you use the term art, most people think you're talking about visual art.
Exactly.
Right?
Drawing.
So they don't,
period.
Their minds don't necessarily go to the performing arts.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, how do you create these spaces so that everyone feels welcome, because they can see themselves there?
Yes, and.
Okay.
You have to look at the barriers, and you can't ever tell me that theater is accessible with a $200 ticket price. You just can't. And so, you know, we have to look at, and we have to be mindful of free programs, right? So I'm not saying or suggesting it's either 200 or free. I think there's a space in there that's probably a little bit, addresses the issue of a ticket price barrier. But we also have to look at who's greeting families and individuals when they're walking into a theater. What are you serving at the concession stand? What are you selling in the gift shop? There's a very big difference, and I've spent the bulk of my career grappling with this idea that there is a world of difference between feeling like you're welcome somewhere and feeling like you belong somewhere.
Exactly. It's like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And belonging.
Right.
You know, there is quite a difference there. So I also wanted to talk about art in schools and how, you know, typically art is the first thing that is defunded. So what are your feelings about how the educational experience can be restructured? Because art is such an important component, and music, and I'm speaking of it in its broadest sense.
So it's a complicated question.
Yes,
and if
it is.
Take the high road, I'll say the Department of Education is doing the best they can, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the ideal situation is that you have a K through 12 sequential arts instruction in the 4 art forms, dance, music, theater, and visual art, taught by a certified art teacher in a space appropriate for that art form, right? How often is a dance class taught? It's not a sprung floor. There's no mirror. There's no bar. Theater class is taught in what used to be like a stock room. And so you would never say to a science teacher, you're not going to have a lab or test tubes. Like, they wouldn't put up with it. But because there is no mandatory tests in the arts, we have no real pull. And so what the ideal situation is that the Department of Education offers sequence and scope, K through 12, and the cultural community, the cultural community that I represent, they go in and open the world to young people. So an art teacher and a theater teacher and a music teacher, they have their hands full teaching. They don't necessarily have to or know, you know, everything that's happening at the Philharmonic. Let the Philharmonic do that. Let Lincoln Center do that. Let New 42 do that. What's happened is that the onus is now on the cultural community to fill in the gap to where the schools aren't doing it. So many arts organizations are the theater teacher. You know, they are the music teacher and the visual arts teacher. That's not their job. It should be a certified art teacher teaching those subjects.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to the fascinating Russell Granite about arts education and arts in the city schools. And I actually have a classic story about that, my experience.
Okay, go right ahead with your classic story.
So I went to, I won't name it, I went to a very tough high school. And I was friends with the hoods. And the reason was is because I drew like a bandit, so there was nothing our teacher could teach me. So I was disrupting. They put me in the back with the thugs. And they loved art school because they could sniff glue in the back of the room. So I had protection.
Real West Side Story all over here.
For me, it was great. So, you know, I was listening to Harry about this research part of it, which I'd like to talk a little bit. Is that right? And if I look at what you guys do in research, it's actually quite fascinating. It cultivates an enduring love of the performing arts. You do expand perspective and interpersonal skills to strengthen teamwork, which goes way beyond art. Inspires creative thinking while encourage innovation and problem solving, and nurtures hope, which foster optimism and resilience. In some ways, it's almost like these, when people talk about art, you know, they think about dalliances. And in some ways, this is something that would impact society in a powerful way.
They're practical life skills.
I mean, could you talk a little bit about that and how you see that manifest itself in the programs you do?
You know, I think in every aspect of what we do, we're trying to give young people the skills to imagine a different life. So that happens in engaging in theater, engaging in music, and sitting in a theater, in talking to actors, and just being a part of the community of the performing arts. And the skills that are learned in that process, and, you know, I'll give you an anecdote in that I'll oftentimes talk to principals and I'll say to them, tell me who you want graduating your school. And they will say, well, I want them to stand tall. I want them to have a strong handshake. I want them to make eye contact. I want them to feel self-assured. I want them to be good public speakers. I want them to offer and have empathy. And I'm like, great. Now point to where in the curriculum you're doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's interesting.
And they can't. And they can point to the art classes, because that all of the things that the principals want their graduates to be happen in the arts classrooms. Yet, as we heard earlier, they're often the first to be cut.
It's almost like that message really should be out there a lot more. You know, I would add, the only thing I would add to that too, because that's a wonderful list, is the ability and how to ask for things.
And to fail. I mean, we have a school system where, and a system at large, that does not celebrate failure. Artists
culture
fail
doesn't celebrate
every
failure.
Day, right? Yeah. I mean, the best thing about, you know, you're a dancer, you fall on the floor, you have a blank canvas, you hit the wrong note. There's not an artist out there that's not like, oh, great, I'm going to try again. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way our schools work.
Well, it's also how not culture works, because there's the myth about failure is that it's a bad thing.
Right.
When it's really a lessons learned.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, right, failure gives
but
you...
But how do you get to greatness?
Right.
You try
learned.
And you fail,
right.
You try and you fail.
Well, that's why it's a stupid myth.
Right, yeah. It is.
So Russell, I want to kind of get into the early part of your career, almost immediately after graduating from the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts. You started working as a teaching artist. And one, you know, what is a teaching artist for those listeners who, you know, that term might be foreign to them? So one, what is a teaching artist? But then, you know, what also are you seeing as trends in the field of education from when you first started out to today?
Well, teaching artist is a translator of art. So it is, at any given time, you're 50% artist and 50% educator. You could be 90% artist and 10% educator. It just depends on the day. But teaching artist is a professional artist that is seeking work in their art form, and they're also educating and working with young people. And what I mean by translators, and I think in Maxine Green, who was a mentor of mine, would talk about how the highest form of artist is one who can translate what they do. Mm. And that teaching artists are, in fact, translators of art. When I started as a teaching artist 30 some odd years ago, it wasn't an industry. You know, it was a job, it was a gig. You worked in the mornings and you had the afternoons to sort of audition. It was, none of your, I don't even know if I had lesson plans. You know, it was, you just, they're like, just keep the kids busy and have a good time. It has evolved into a very sophisticated field where it's linked to standards and there are lesson plans and child development. I mean, they're all, every aspect of being a teaching artist is the best of being a teacher and the best of being an artist. And so I'm thrilled over the 30 years to watch it really become an industry. And there are full-time teaching artists that are out there in the world. And thank goodness, because schools have enough teachers, they don't have enough artists in the building. So we need more teaching artists in the building.
It seems to be like an opportunity for employment for artists to a certain extent.
It's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
Although you have to like kids. Like
if the, yeah, of course.
You know, that, but I don't say that lightly because I work with artists who are teaching artists and I'll observe them. And I'm like, you don't really seem to have any patience. And they're like, yeah, it's not really working for me.
I'd like to talk a little bit about technology. Like how does it support not only students, but teaching artists in the work that they do? And also, how does that bridge the gap between art education and accessibility through programs like New Victory on Demand?
So technology became front and center 3 years ago. We had, you know, we shut down on March 13th, the way the rest of the world shut down. And by Monday, March 16th, we were up with a digital product. And it was really driven by the fact that our staff are parents and educators. And many of us have kids. And we're like, what is Monday going to look like with our kids in the background sort of stuff? And so could we create an opportunity for parents, educators, and students to participate in art making at home without needing really anything? Because you couldn't go to the store to get props or instruments. And so, you know, if we were teaching tap, it was grab some coins, tape them to the bottom of your shoe, and find a flat surface. So we tried to create any opportunity for families to create it. And so our digital work, the online component, really kept our artists employed, which was really important to me personally. Because the art, you know, as an arts administrator, many of us remained employed because we had to keep our buildings going. But our artists, you know, the cleaners of the theater, the box office,
right.
There's no work. And so we tried to create as much work for our teams as we could. And so the arts break, it became so popular that PBS broadcast it. So the million plus viewers of our work, that's just on our platforms.
Wow.
That doesn't speak to the millions. We were in 47 affiliates across the U.S.
Wow, that's amazing.
So we had huge reach. So in a year when our theater was closed, we probably had more reach than in any year that we were open. But for us, it was important to get the message out. What's interesting with the digital work is that initially our audience was sort of the tri-state area. Our regular audience was seeing us. But we realized that we had a large international audience, a large rural audience. And those families were saying, you know, post-pandemic, please keep the digital piece alive because there is no victory in driving distance to where we live. And so you actually opened up that world to us, and we want to continue watching and being a part of it.
Can you talk to us about LabWorks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because to me, that program is really fascinating. You know, I think it's one that relates to BIPOC families. Talk to us about what that program is.
So LabWorks is an artist development program, and it's been at New Victory for a long time, mm-hmm. but it has evolved more recently. And what we know from our own research is much of the work that's put on the stage for young people, although the actors may be artists of color, mm-hmm. the creative teams were not.
And
I don't have don't quote me on this, but it's something like 93% of the work created for young people were created by white artistic teams. Again, doesn't mean the artists on stage were white, but it means the people who are creating it,
right.
The choreographers, the directors, the playwrights. And the thing about New 42, and I went to New Victory when I didn't work in New Victory with my daughter, because the work always had such respect for the young person. There is a lot of really awful theater for young people. And in this country, it is seen as, oh, that's what you do when you couldn't do something else. Like, I'm a playwright, I want to be on Broadway. I don't necessarily want to be a playwright and be at the New Victory. And that narrative has to change because that's our future audience. And the work that we're putting on our stages, anyone in this room would enjoy because it is just good quality work. And so LabWorks is investing in artists, and we're investing in artists of color who want to work in this space. Because we need to generate more work, not for the New Victory, but for other regional theaters. You know, my feeling always is the better the work for everybody, it's just good for everybody.
Right.
So it's not as if we own this process. We just want to get as many artists out there to be in the field, and so more audiences can see the work.
Russell, I have a question. You know, following the trajectory of your career, you've always centered equity and what it is that you do, whether it's at the Center for Arts Education, whether it's at Lincoln Center, or now as president of New 42, equity is always at the center of your work, even when your contemporaries may not be thinking in an equity mindset. When did this social justice compass start to develop for you?
I think I grew up in a household where we were fortunate enough to have resources and access to the arts at a young age. And I know that the arts were so instrumental. I was not a good test taker. As you, thank you for mentioning that earlier.
I wanted company.
But where I excelled were the in the arts classrooms. And so from a very young age, I knew how impactful the arts were for me. And then as a teaching artist, when I got into the schools and I was like, wait, this is one school system and the inequity within one system. So you can go to, and I used to think it was neighborhood-based. It's not even neighborhood-based. You can walk into one, meaning that if it's a poor neighborhood, the schools aren't as good, and if it's a wealthy neighborhood, the schools are. That's actually not true. You can go to neighborhoods and next door to each other. In an affluent neighborhood, you can have one of the best schools and one of the worst schools. The inequity in our public school system is huge. And I think that it's our job, a place like New 42 and artists in general, just to make sure that all families have access. Like, I don't, if somebody sees theater and they hate it, I'm fine with that. I'm not fine with it if they don't think it's for them.
Or that they've never seen it.
Or that's, but that's why they don't see it, is because they think it's for other people.
Absolutely. You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Russell Granite. Russell, in my research for you, I, you know, came across a quote of yours that I just found really amazing, would like to unpack. And you talked about not wanting to walk into communities and thinking that you have the answers. You talk to us about what that means and what a pro, just like you said, that the thought is behind the scenes, the Black people or the people of color are on stage, but all the thinking that's going on does not include them. And you're also talking about not going into communities thinking you know what the answer is or not. Yes. So could you speak to that?
Or that you're going into communities thinking you're going to fix the community. That's the complete wrong mindset. There are certainly people out there who believe that arts and culture live in Manhattan and maybe Brooklyn, but that there isn't an understanding that arts and culture live in every borough and every pocket. And it's not, you know, I'll often say it's, we're working with people with limited access to the kind of work that we put on our stage. It's not limited access to the arts, because arts live across the city, across all five boroughs. And I'm also a little bit cautious of any program that's free to families, because oftentimes those programs have inventory, and they have inventory for a reason, which means no one's buying the tickets to those shows.
That's right.
And then the other piece of it is when the families do show up, and for some of our families, it's the first time to Manhattan, it's the first time to Times Square. They're sitting so far from the stage that they might as well just be, they'd have a better shot at seeing this at home on television. And so I think if we're going to be serious about breaking down the barriers for families coming to see theater, we have to invest in good seats that are at affordable price, being greeted by people who not only look like them, but respect them, and that there's a sense of belonging. And you have to not only see yourself on stage, you have to be able to see yourself in the audience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Russell, we mentioned earlier about just how you've been doing this work, even when it wasn't necessarily, you know, a la mode in the moment to do it. What would you say to others, right, who are exhibiting a more performative style or more performative form of allyship? You know, we saw a lot of solidarity statements come out following the murder of George Floyd with no real strategy or action plan attached. What advice would you give to individuals or these institutions to move past that performative mode of allyship to one that is more about being an accomplice or a co-conspirator in the move to liberate Black and brown bodies?
I think you have to look at who keeps showing up. I saw a lot of people showing up 2 years ago, and I don't see it as much as I did. And there was a situation, and Darrell, you might remember this from our days together at Lincoln Center, but we were doing a residency in a school, and a young man had a basketball. And we were doing theater activities. And the teaching artist was like, you got to put the basketball down. And the teacher's like, no, please don't ask him to put that basketball down. Because that basketball for him is, it, you know, it's his version of, he needs that to get through school.
Yeah, of course.
And we were there for 1 year. The second year, still holding the basketball. At the end of the second year, this teaching artist walks in and he puts the basketball down on the floor. Mm. And she was in tears. She's like, I don't know why I'm crying. All I know is that he trusted me enough to put the basketball down. And I think it's this idea of you go in, you try something, it didn't work. And it's like, we tried. I think you got to keep showing up.
I'm thinking about, you know, your new 42. And do you have pipeline programs for kids? Because you said you're not necessarily trying to create artists. So in this process, are you affiliated with, say, colleges and universities? And what is that? What does that structure look like? Because I've often felt that a new Vic should be on one of these city college campuses, some sort of satellite, so that you can attract those kids into those places to further their education.
Yeah, we have a long-standing youth development program.
Okay,
and so students are with us for 3 years for the Usher Corps. And we have a special relationship with the union that allows us to have young people run our theaters. So 25 years ago when the New Victory was born, so was the Youth Corps program. And so they stay with us from 18 to 21. These are students that are in the public school system. 95% of them are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And they're, again, some of them come to us not being interested in the arts. They seem, oh, it seems like it might be a good gig. And over the course of 3 years, they're learning about marketing and they're learning about development and they're learning about how to be an usher, how to run a concession stand. And so the skills that they're learning, they'll take with them for the rest of their life. And New 42 covers about 36,000 hours a year of paid employment for our youth.
Oh, wow. Wow.
You know, I have first-hand experience of the program because when I said I remembered many years ago, I took a juggling class with my six-year-old at that time. Yep. It was great. So, anyways, so we're just curious about some of the things like who funds New Victory? Is that has come from a variety of funding?
Yeah, it's a variety of, you know, we're fortunate to have an incredible board. And that you can't underestimate the power
you
of
sure
the board
can.
Of directors
no,
with
right.
an amazing sure board chair. A little shout out to Fiona Rudin.
Oh, wow.
It
oh,
really
Rudin.
Is. It, that helps. Couldn't hurt.
Right.
But smart and caring and very good as chair. So we have a phenomenal board. We have a strong base of foundation support. We get a lot of support from the city because we are in public, we're in buildings owned by the city. We might be the leaseholder, but the city owns the buildings. And we do a lot of, you know, strong individuals. So, you know, it's a healthy kind of pie of individuals, corporations, government, and board.
So it just, you know, it reminds me of a story about this myth about artists not making a living on it. It's like, I was friend of Dennis Oppenheim, the sculptor, I don't know who he was. He once told me that the parent's worst nightmare is their child becoming a performance artist. Anyway, so you had a question.
No. We're dispelling that myth, right? We're
yes.
saying,
well,
we're
no,
saying
yeah,
that
this
you
is,
can make.
No, he was kidding.
I know,
kidding.
But now you can actually make a living with art. It's just that simple. So,
but also going to apply for a job. Corporate America wants people to think differently.
Absolutely.
They don't want people on factory lines. Like they want people thinking in different ways. And those are the people coming out of conservatory. Those are the people coming out of strong arts programs.
What is it that the new MBA is the MFA?
Yeah.
Somebody coined that. So
you said that, right?
I've always felt that certain companies, I used to work for an energy company and I felt we needed artists on in residence. You know, we needed that so that we could start to think a little out of the box. But anyway, Russell, it was wonderful having you. Thank you
so much
for sharing your knowledge and your insight in arts education.
Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Koslansky and our distinguished co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.